Introducing Rabbi Evan Hoffman at 8 o'clock sharp on a Thursday evening as we zip along with Zoom on our Parsha and pizza night. Hold up your pizza, Chaim.
No, I finished it.
He finishes pizza. Rabbi Hoffman, if you hear, you get a slice.
Thank you.
And Parsha Shmot, thank you. Coming all the way from Manchi Shalom, New Rochelle, New York. Take it away, Rabbi Hoffman.
Good evening or good afternoon, depending upon where you are. I'm actually not in the shul, I'm at home because quarantining here. We have COVID in the house. Everybody's fine. Everybody's fine. So the pasuk we're going to focus on
now. This is it's very. It could be very positive, and I don't mean just the test.
Yeah. So Vayomer Aleihem Melech Mitzrayim, Haro says to them, meaning Moshe and Aaron, Lama Moshe v'Aaron Tafrit Amasav. Why are you bothering the people from their activities? Lechu l'siv lo teichem. Go tend to your own burdens. So the question is, what is the meaning of lechu l'siv lo teichem, your own burdens? Rashi says,
which tells the pasuk, so we know where we are.
Perikei pasuk dal. Perikei pasuk. The last phrase of perikei pasuk dal. So what is the meaning of lechu l'siv lo teichem? Rashi says, lechu l'malach teichem. Go to your own work. That you have to do in your own homes, meaning whatever keeps you busy. But as for the labor, which is part of the subjugation of the Hebrews by the Egyptians, the tribe of Levi was exempt from those burdens. And the proof, Rashi says, is that Moshe and Aaron just come and go as they please to have their encounters with Paro, with the king of Egypt. So it's implied then that if they were busy with working, if they had the servitude imposed upon them, they would not be able to come and go to talk to the boss.
Maybe people 80 and older might have been exempt.
Maybe. You could argue that, you know, age was a factor, but what is being argued here is that tribal association was the determining factor, that because they were Levites, the tribe of Levi was, you know, exempt. Now,
it seems very weak, doesn't it?
Very, very weak, very weak. And I'm going to explain to you, not only is it weak, but we can prove why this was said. And it's not because it's true, but rather for other reasons. Okay, so The basic point here is l'sivlo teichem, your burdens, as opposed to the burdens of the state or that the state imposes upon you. So the sivlo teichem, the chem aspect, is the main hook textually for this Rashi, but also the logical inference of, well, if they were working, they couldn't come and go as they please. So two factors: the logic of the story and the grammar of the last word. Now let's go to the Ramban. The Ramban says, "Al derech hapshat." The basic pshat here is avodat hamelech, that the sivlot echem does not mean your private work that you do from home, you know, that you sell stuff on Amazon. No, it means the work imposed by the government upon you, because you're Hebrews and the Hebrews are slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt.
It was a threat.
What?
It was a threat.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, you guys are free. Maybe you need something to take up your time. You're some burden, huh? It was
okay. So the Medrash will get to that issue. I mean, you're not busy enough. Let me make you busy. So Shaya Miklala Am, that they were part of the people. The first time Moshe and Aaron were not the only ones to show up to Pharaoh. A whole contingent of the leadership of the people came with them. So what does Paro say? Go back to all your work. But it's not being addressed only to Moshe. It's being addressed to everybody. You're as a rabble of Hebrews here, 100 people. You guys, get back to work. Okay, so now, Rashi Pirish, but then Ramban quotes Rashi. L'malachtechem sheshtrem baratechem. What you have to do at home, you know, your private gig that you have at home selling stuff on Amazon. V'malecha shibim mitzrayim. That was not on the Shevet Levi. So Ramban first says the pshat is get back to the work of Egypt. Then he quotes Rashi saying, well, no, that's not the work of Egypt, but your own private affairs. Okay, because the tribe of Levi didn't work in the servitude. Then he says, "V'nachon hu." Rashi's interpretation is nachon. Usually he'll say, "Eino nachon." Rashi's not right. Now he's saying, although the pshat is against Rashi, Rashi has a point here. He seems to be right. And then, "U'minig b'chol am yoslehem l'chacham moreh torasim." It's the practice in all nations that there are teachers of religion, sages, wise men, elders. Pharaoh allowed the Levites to function as the elders and the sages of Israel. And it's all from Hashem. Okay, and then he quotes the Medrash, which I'll get to shortly. Okay, so what he's suggesting here is that Pharaoh, although he's the leader of the dominant group here, he's the boss, and the Hebrews are an ethnic underclass who work for him. He understands that every subgroup of humanity, even people who are pretty down in the dumps, have to have some leadership cadre that teach them, you know, their religious laws, their mores, whatever it is, including the Hebrews, and for that the Levites get to do that. Okay, let's go to the Chizkuni. The Chizkuni really takes things in an interesting direction. The Chulasiv lo techem. So the Chizkuni takes for granted, based upon Midrashim that I haven't quoted to you yet, but which are undergirding Rashi's interpretation as well, that the tribe of Levi was exempt from servitude. So the question is, why were they exempt?
You mentioned about teachers. I thought you had Shimon with the teachers, or Yisachar with the intercalators, they were the math guys. What is Levi? They're the ritual people in the Mishkan, which is
okay. Maybe. So you're right that over the wide scope of rabbinic literature, there are four different tribes that at various times are identified as scholars and teachers and the like. Yes, Yisachar, on the basis of Yisachar Chamor Garim and the Yisachar Zavulun Deal. Okay, and there's one pasuk somewhere in Divrei Hayamim that alludes to that, but it's very, very shvach, the idea of Yisachar. Shimon is because it says that they were supposed to be gallivanting all over the country, that they shouldn't be in one spot, so they were Malamde Tinokos, that they had to go from this place to that place, hither and yon, because if they were concentrated in one area, they would be too rambunctious. Yehuda, because the leadership is in their hands, and the tribe of Levi, which really is an ecclesiastical bunch, but ecclesiastical bunch is being identified also with scholarship, because there was a monopoly over scholarship in the hands of the sacerdotal functionaries. So depending upon which medrash you quote, you could say it's Shimon, Yisachar, Levi, Yehuda. Yes, you have other various options out there. But with focusing on Levi now, so how did Levi merit to be exempt from work in Mitzrayim? Well, the Chizkuni says, because in the beginning, the work in Mitzrayim was discretionary, that Paro fooled people into getting them to work by himself going and getting down and dirty with the brick pit. And the people said, well, if Paro's going to do it, we should join in too. And then once they joined in, they could never escape the servitude. It became compulsory and they had to do it. But who never joined in on a voluntary basis? The tribe of Levi. Why? Because Yaakov had promised the tribe of Levi that when they come out of Mitzrayim and they'll get the Torah and they'll have a Mishkan, that the Aron Kodesh, the Aron HaBris, will be on their shoulders. So how could they defile their shoulders with pharaonic bricks when their shoulders are supposed to be reserved for the Ark of God?
I think the Levi was exempt because they were the clergy in the same way that the Egyptian clergy was exempt.
Okay. So now you're getting towards the right answer. So Chizkuni gives this answer, which is a very embellished answer that requires you to say that the Levites knew because Yaakov told them about a Mishkan and Aaron. It's very, very far-fetched. Okay, so now let's go to the Medrash itself, because all these Rishonim, the medieval commentaries, are relying upon a line in the Medrash. What does the Medrash say? Amar Rabbi Shur ben Levi, Shivto shel Levi, Hanui haya me'avodas parah. The tribe of Levi was exempted, was free from the difficult labor, the avodas parah, the backbreaking labor. Amar lehem paro, so paro says to them, Ishvil shatim omdim penuyim atim omrim milchan is b'chalul kenu, b'chul zivotechim amar yilis royal. So he says, because you guys are busy doing nothing, that's why you get this idea, a bug up you, that you have to go sacrifice to your deity in the wilderness. So therefore, what are you better off doing? Get to work, you know. It's not enough for you that you're free from work. People who are not busy working, because they get bad ideas in their head. You'd be better served working. Okay? So that's the Medrash. The Medrash is Yeshua ben Levi. Now bear in mind when Yeshua ben Levi lives. He's a mid-third century Eretz Yisrael Amora. All right? And keep that in mind. Now, is the fact that it says Sivlo Techem necessarily instructive that it was the burdens of Moshe and Aaron and not the burdens of Mitzrayim because they were exempt from the burdens of Mitzrayim? Does the word Sivlo Techem necessarily mean that? So the answer is no. And how do I know it's no? Because read Pasuk Hey. Bruce, open your Chumash. Read Pasuk Hey.
So Pharaoh says, behold, the people of the land are now numerous, and you would have them cease from their burdens?
Okay, so here, Paro says, Sivlo Tam, about the other Hebrews. And that's clearly the job that he wants them to do, the burdens of Egypt. And he refers to it as Sivlo Tam. So in the preceding verse, when he says Sivlo Techem, that just because he's talking to them directly, it's the same meaning as Sivlotam. It means the burdens of Egypt. So whatever Midrashic interpretation that says Sivlotechem necessarily means, well, not the burdens of Egypt, but your own private burdens, it's not borne out by the very next pasuk. And where do we find any other reference to Sivlot? In Parshas Va'era, next week, Perek Vav, Pasuk Zayin. V'lakachti etchem lila'am. Hashem says, I'll take them for a people. Okay? You know that I'm the Lord your God. That I took you from the Sivlot Mitzrayim. So when God is talking about Israel, he refers to it as Sivlot Mitzrayim because in fact it was the burdens imposed by Egypt upon them. When Paro speaks to a Hebrew, he says your burdens, because as far as he's concerned, your burdens are my burdens. You do whatever I tell you to do. So I've basically just debunked the idea that Sivlotechem means your private burdens. And yet the Midrash is running wild with it and saying on the basis of that one word, the tribe of Levi was exempt. So clearly there's an agenda here because the plain reading doesn't really bear it out. Okay, now.
Well, isn't that at the heart of Midrash?
What was that?
Midrash always has an agenda. I mean, it does.
Okay,
it's
so,
not
so, so, the,
I mean,
so, the, so so the question then is, can we identify what that agenda is? And today I'll tell you that on this particular subject, we can, with a very great specificity, we can. Okay? So that's why I'm excited about this topic, because there's not a lot of conjecture here. We're really going to get to the right answer. Okay. Now, Bruce had said that in Egypt, they recognize that the clergy are exempt from things. Where do we find this? In Parshas Vayigash from 2 weeks ago, that when Yosef is buying up all the land of Mitzrayim in return for the bar, for the grain that he stored up, who didn't have to sell their land?
Egyptian clergy.
Kohanim lo kana. The priests of Egypt didn't sell their land. Why? Because they were getting a chok. They were getting an allotted portion on a regular basis, and so they didn't need to sell their land. Okay, and Rakat Kohanim Levadam Lo Hayta LaParo. So they were able to maintain their parsonage, their land. Well, the question now is, I understand that clergy exemption as a concept makes sense. It makes sense. We find it in Egypt among the indigenous Egyptians. We find the Ramban theorizing that the Egyptians recognize that it's true about every society, including an underclass that they have subjugated. Okay, but was it necessarily the tribe of Levi? When does the tribe of Levi elevate itself or get elevated by some higher authority to the position of ecclesiastical functionary or teacher of religious wisdom? However you want to say that they're important, when does that happen?
After the exchange for the firstborn.
Bingo. So you're looking at the source. Did you print the source sheet?
No, I never got the
source sheet. Okay, so for those, did you send out the source sheet?
No, I didn't. It was here. I'll send it right now.
Okay, all right. So for those keeping score at home on the source sheet, that's the very next thing. So the first reference to the tribe of Levi being special, is in Bamidbar chapter 1, verse 49. Achet matel Levi lo tivkod, Rosh HaMetusah, don't include the Levites in the census. Why not? Well, because they have a special role to play in society, that of sacerdotal functionary. So Bamidbar chapter 3, verse 6, they shall serve Aaron, the high priest, that they serve a subsidiary role among the ecclesiastical workers. That Aaron is, the big boss, and his sons are Kohanim, and the Levim play second fiddle, but they play a role. Okay, now let's go to chapter 3, verse 12 in Bamidbar. Vani ne lakachti Levim li mitoch bnei Israel. Levim are chosen as special functionaries in the cultus because they are successors and replacements for the firstborn. But why were the firstborn at all relevant? Because of Makat Bechorot, because the very next pasuk says, so if the Levim are a replacement for the Bechor, and the Bechor only got their status because of the episode of Makat Bechorot, then in the era before Makat Bechorot, there's no logical basis to assume that the Levim had any special status. So any claim of the Levim were exempt from Avodah and Mitzrayim, and Paro knows this and recognizes it, in Exodus chapter 3.
Does Yaakov give to the Levim, to the Levi, on his deathbed?
Well, nothing. He curses them for killing the people of Shechem.
There's no perk to Levi.
No. Okay, so where is the perk to the Levim? Only in the latter books of the Torah, the priestly emoluments, the Trumas and Maaseres sections of Bamidbar and Devarim. In Moshe's valedictory, in Vezot HaBracha, so we have an idea that the Levim are teachers of Torah. Yoru Mishpatecha LeYaakov, V'Torat Chali Yisrael. So the Keturah is the Kohanic branch of the Levim, but the Levim more generally are Yor Mishpatecha, they're teachers of Torah, the Mishpatim. They'll issue guidance and instruction in the laws of our nation. So yes, the Levim are teachers of Torah, but was that the case in pre-Sinaitic times? There's no basis for that. Yeah.
Don't we learn that Amram was sort of the head of the community, and here Paro is seeing the sons of Amram, and perhaps out of deference to that tribe with that family, he parted them from work. Perhaps.
Any idea that Amram was a big shot is not based upon the text of the Torah itself. It may be based upon the later Agadic literature. So I can find a very early reference to the singling out of Levi as being important and as a teacher of Torah and as someone who might be deserving of clergy exemptions. We find it in the Book of Jubilees. Book of Jubilees is written 2,100 years ago, 2,150 years ago. The Book of Jubilees is basically like a fabrication of the Torah. It's like a falsification of the Torah in the sense that they take the stories of the Bible and twist them ever so slightly to pursue some other angle. And you'll see that clearly if you have did you put the source sheet on the WhatsApp or the link here?
Okay. I emailed Arthur. I emailed it and I sent it to you.
Okay, so for those keeping the score at home, look in Jubilees chapter 31, verses 11 through 15. I'll read it to you. And the darkness left the eyes of Isaac, and he saw the two sons of Jacob, Levi and Judah, and said, are these your sons? For they are like thee. And he said unto him, they are truly his sons. And thou hast truly seen that they are truly my sons. And they came near to him. And he turned and kissed them and embraced them both together. And the spirit of prophecy came down into his mouth. And he took Levi by his right hand and Judah by his left hand. He turned to Levi first and began to bless him and say, now, what story of the Torah is this being copied off of?
Yaakov with the Menashe and Ephraim.
Correct. This is Ephraim and Menashe all over, except in Book of Jubilees, it's not Yaakov who's the granddaddy. It's Isaac who's the granddaddy.
But I don't get it. Everyone knows the correct story. Like, how could they fall for this?
Like, I don't know. I wasn't alive back then. So, so now, what does he say about Levi? He says, they shall be judges and princes and chiefs of all the seed of the sons of Jacob. They shall speak the word of the Lord in righteousness. They shall judge all his judgments in righteousness. They shall declare my ways to Jacob and my path to Israel. Basically, they're Dayanim, Moritz Sedek, they're Laman Tinokas, whatever it is. They're teaching Torah to the people. They are the rabbis, basically. They're the clergy. That's the tribe of Levi. So already in the Book of Jubilees, Second Temple times, 2,100 years ago, 2,200 years ago, this idea existed. That the Rambam, borrowing from certain other lines that appear in Psikta de Rav Kahana and the Targumim, also runs with this and says the following. Hilchos Avodos Kochavim, he says, V'yakov Avinu lamad limed banav kulam v'yivdil Levi minehu rosh v'yeshiva b'yeshiva. Yaakov made Levi the rosh yeshiva. L'lamed derech Hashem l'shmritzis Avram, to keep the commandments of Abraham. So the Levite family, generation after generation, will be the rabbis, will be the teachers. Fine. Good. Okay, so the Levium and the Mitzrayim were, according to the Rambam, who's borrowing from earlier Midrashic traditions, from Midrash HaGadol, that the Levium were the Rebbes and the teachers. And they were very frum, and everybody else wasn't so frum. Okay. So fine, I now have identified that in the homiletic tradition, we've said, not based upon a plain reading of the text of the Torah, but based upon a homiletic tradition, that the Levium were the clergy in yesteryear. Okay, but now the question is, did the Gentiles allow for exemptions from whatever kind of taxation and service, compulsory service, for Jewish clergy? It's one thing for us to say that we had clergy and we'll identify who they were, but the goyim have to give the exemptions.
The Gemara mentions tax exemptions for Talmid Chachamim.
Okay, good. We're going to get to that. Good, very good. Okay. Now, so here, the pasuk in Ezra chapter 7, verse 24, V'lachem ha-hoda'in di'kol kahonaya v'leviyaya zamaraya v'taraya v'tinaya palche beit alaha. So the Persian monarch is declaring that anybody who works in the temple, whether they're a Kohen or a Levi or a chorister or a Nathenite who is a water drawer and a woodchopper, whoever they are, they're all going to be exempt from certain taxation. So Rashi explains, I declare to you, so the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the songsters, the water drawers and wood choppers, the slaves who work in the house of God, nobody shall impose any servitude upon them, who impose upon them mas, taxation, the kesef gulgolot, a head tax, a poll tax, rather they shall be free from the servitude of the king, that basically the temple shall be allowed to function and its employees shall be off the hook from government service, government taxation, government service. That's a wonderful thing. Kudos to the Persian monarch for allowing that. Okay, well, that's all well and good to say that it applies to those who work in the Beit HaMikdash. But is service in the sacrificial center, the Beit HaMikdash, where there are korbanot, where there are offerings, is that the same thing as post-temple era clergy that, you know, officiated funerals and weddings and teach shiurim? Is that the same thing as a guy who spills blood on the altar and sings songs and it's in the temple?
No, but since the Kohanim couldn't own land, the idea was, I thought, in place of being farmers like everybody else, they'd be the teachers.
Okay, so granted that's true, but is it necessarily the case that we're going to now say that anyone of any ethnic background who chooses to go into religious work will benefit from the same kinds of exemptions that the earlier Gentile authorities conferred upon those who function in a temple where they kill animals and spill blood and offer incense. Is it going to be the same thing or not? So let's go to the Psikta. So the Psikta says, Aser ta'aser. Now, Aser ta'aser, okay, we read this Torah reading every Yontif. What is that all about? If you're Meiser, who does the Meiser go to?
The
Levitical class.
Well, they lost it. Didn't Israel take that away from them?
What?
Don't the Levim lose that?
Yes, yeah, so that's a separate topic, not for tonight. The Kohanim at one point in time expropriated the Maaserishim from the Levim for not being frum enough. Yes. Okay, but the Torah says the Levim get the Maaser. The Psikta says, Amar Bar Kahana, Ramaz le Pargumotufsin, Lemafarshe Yamim, to teach you that the mercantilists and those who travel on the seas shall give one tenth of their earnings to those who study Torah, to those who delve in the Torah. So here you have a psikta, an agadic medrash, saying, yeah, the Torah gives meiser to the Levi, but guess what? Now we'll give meiser to the Talmidei Chachamim. So you see that the rabbis, I'm not going to say self-serving, but they're transferring a perk from a genealogical line to a profession, the profession of learning and teaching. Okay. The Rambam continues along these lines and says in Hilchos Shmita V'Yovel, V'lo shevet Levi b'levad, fine. Anybody, not just from Shevet Levi, but from any tribe who wants to cast off the burdens of regular life and take on the burdens of Torah and teaching Torah. So, you know, they're able to do that, you know, and they're going to be supported. Okay. So they'll get the benefits, the perks along the lines that the Kohanim and Levim used to have. Fine. So now we've established that in the Jewish tradition, in the rabbinic tradition and in the Rishonic tradition, that what? That there is such a thing as clergy exemption. It was once about korbanot and temples. It's no longer. It's now about Torah and the teaching of Torah. That we're going to retroject that back to the days of the patriarchs and say that Yaakov imposed this kind of burden upon Levi, and that the Egyptians recognized it. And so that's why Moshe and Aaron didn't work. So we've now tied together all the pieces of the puzzle. But the question is, why does this puzzle exist at all? Why did we have to go through all this? What were they trying to accomplish? And the answer is because the rabbis of the Talmudic era wanted these exemptions from public service and from taxation, both in the Eastern provinces under the control of the Sassanid Persians, and in the Western provinces under the control of the Roman Empire, whether the Byzantine or even the far Western Roman Empire. So let's now go to, if you're looking at the source sheet, on the second page of the source sheet, Tanhuma Va'era Simen Dalid. So it's before the English language stuff. If you printed it, this is the key line. So Amar Rabbi Yehuda ben Halevi, although some versions have it as Rama Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, okay, Shivto shel Levi hayapanui liturgia b'mitzrayim. The tribe of Levi was exempt from the liturgia of Egypt. What is liturgy? L-I-T-U-R-G-Y. What does that mean, liturgy?
It's the words that you daven with.
Okay, good. So in modern English, liturgy refers to the wording of religious worship services, the prayer services. But if you go into your Jastrow dictionary, and if you go on Wikipedia or whatever it is your source of choice, and you ask Rabbi Google, what is the meaning of liturgy in the classical, you know, Roman imperial context, it refers to civic obligations, communal service, public service that is imposed upon people because civilization needs people to pay taxes, to serve on town councils, to collect the taxes, to do all sorts of things to make society function. The liturgies are those burdens. Well, what's the crossover between liturgy of modern English and the liturgy of the Roman Empire? The crossover is that some of these liturgies involved a religious component, and the saying of words in the worship of the pantheon of Jupiter, etc. So from a Jewish point of view, was it a good thing or a bad thing to be a member of the decurionate, to be a deacon, to be someone who had to pay taxes, to be a liturgist? Well, from a financial point of view, you'd love to be exempt. Why should I have to pay if somebody else can pay it? You know, why fund the public opera or fund the public sporting arena with my money? You let somebody else pay for it. But also, if as a public servant who has to pay the taxes, I also have to be involved in the assemblies, and those assemblies involve what? An element of religious worship, which is pagan, which is Avodah Zarah, I'm going to say that my religious scruples prevent me from doing this. Then the question will be, well, will the Goyish government accept my excuse and, in fact, excuse me and give me an exemption? Or will they say, tough noogies, you have to do it?
Well, doesn't that depend upon how they handled their clergy? I mean, Roman Empire, which was Christian-led, they're exempt from all kinds of stuff.
So Bruce is right. In part, it's going to depend upon what kind of exemptions exist for Christian clergy. But it's also going to depend upon how kindly disposed was the empire, or any, not just Rome, but any empire, towards the religious sensibilities of Jews. You know, we're a very intolerant religion, intolerant in the sense that polytheists can worship whatever god they want and throw some rice petals onto some other guy's god, but we have a Kale Kana, a zealous god. We believe in monotheism, one only, and we can't stray from that even in the slightest. So it's going to be a question, but for the most part, Jews were exempted in the Roman Empire from whatever public service required a violation of their religious scruples. But what about the money angle? The money angle is important too. Okay, so...
So we were exempted, I think, because of Shabbat and Kasher. It's almost like an Israeli army today. They don't really want Haredim in the army, and the Romans just don't want to deal with Jews in the military. So they exempted them.
There's a strong part to that, yes. So now let's go to the Theodosian Code, the Codex Theodosius. So the Theodosian Code, which was published in 438, was a collection of all the laws that had been passed in the imperial era up until that time that was still considered on the books. And Constantine, who converted to Christianity and converted the empire to Christianity, although didn't make it the state religion, did not become the state religion until the 380s, but he's shifting the equation in favor of Christianity. In the year 330, there was a law passed on the relation of the Jews to the decurionate, meaning the obligation of Jews to participate in public service. And it was determined that anyone who was associated with the Patriarch and the Sanhedrin, the priests and teachers of Israel, shall be exempted from the decurionate. They were the clergy exemption for those associated with the Sanhedrin and the Nasi. And in 331, again, the immunities of synagogue authorities.
Does the Exilarch have the same thing in the East?
So the empire had not yet been divided at that point. In theory, this applies both to East and West. The immunities of the synagogue authorities, that if you are a synagogue functionary, you're not going to be called for public service if you were not yet already called. If you had already been called, then you remained subject to it indefinitely. Okay, now, but in 383, under Gratian, a later emperor, the rule was that the Jewish clergy were not going to be exempted from the decurionate. They would be obligated in the liturgies to pay taxes and to participate in civic affairs, but they could exempt themselves if they did the same thing as the Christian clergy. The Christian clergy had sworn to themselves a life of poverty, chastity, and obedience. If you don't have stuff, there's nothing to tax. But did the rabbis have to forswear material possessions? In our religion, do the rabbis have to do that? No. rabbis can be rich. Okay, I know plenty of rich rabbis, certainly in Manhattan. All right. Well, so the thinking was, if you don't want to be called for public service, you don't want, then your stuff hefker, give it over to somebody else and make yourself into a pauper, an aniv evyom. And then you can be exempted from public service. Okay. So that's how it relates to the Codex Theodosian. What about in the Gemara? So the Gemara has an important story in the East and an important story in the West. The story in the East is a Gemara Nedarim in Samach Beis Med Beis. So Amar Rava, Rava says in Babylonia, Shari Leila Ritzuba Rabbana, the Memra Yehavna Karga. So the rabbis can say, I won't pay a certain tax, the Karga. Because then he quotes the Pasuk from Ezra that clergy are exempt. Now, the Pasuk in Ezra was about temple workers, not about Tamid Chachamim. But Rav is saying Tamid Chachamim is the same thing. It's like the temple workers of old. Okay? And then Rav said, but the rabbi, young rabbi can say, Uvda Denura Ana, I work for the fire worshippers. And I don't pay the karga. Why? Why can he say such a thing? Isn't that saying like you're a pagan? How can a young rabbi say I'm a pagan? So he says, no. I'm just trying to escape the tax. So since I'm just trying to get out of paying a tax, I can stretch the truth a little bit in ways that actually sound almost blasphemous and sacrilegious, but you can do it. A Talmid Chacham can get out of paying tax by hook or by crook.
What Gemara is that in?
It's Gemara Nedarim, 62b. So that goes to show you that Babylonian Jewry appreciated the notion of clergy exemption and were willing to take chances to get it, okay? So now let's go to Eretz Yisrael. Basra 7b and 8a. Rav Yehuda Nesia, so Rebbe's grandson, Rav Yehuda Nesia, we're talking about middle of the 3rd century, right around the time of, remember what I said, Yehoshua ben Levi lived in the middle of the 3rd century, and he's the one who said what? That L'chulasiv lotechem means that the tribe of Levi was exempt from service in Mitzrayim. Well, his
name is Ben Levi.
Okay, what?
His name is Yehuda Ben Levi.
All right, yes, Ben Levi, fine. But his contemporary Yehuda Nesia, the patriarch, Rama Deshura de Rabbanan, he tried to tax the rabbis. Resh Lakish said, Rabbanan Latzurech Netiruta. Well, the rabbis don't need protection, meaning you're taxing us to build a town wall. For physical protection. You know, you pass an infrastructure bill in Congress, all of a sudden you gotta pay for it. We're going to put a wall around the town. Everybody's got to put it into the coffers. Oh, the rabbis don't need protection. Why? Because our Torah protects us. Okay, sort of a very Haredi perspective. Our Torah protects us. So I don't want to pay. And we don't have to read the whole Gemara, but he quotes a pasuk from the Nevi'im, to prove the point. Then he talks to
Rabbi. Was the idea was these were full-time students and they really weren't working and they really didn't have anything?
Not necessarily. Plenty of them could have had livelihoods. They just felt that we're deserving of an exemption. We deserve an exemption. So Rabbi Yochanan, who was Reish Lakish's collaborator and interlocutor, he says, well, I quote a different pasuk. Ani choma v'shadai kamigdalot. Ani choma zu Torah v'shadai kamigdalot zu bete midrasho. Okay, so you have these, you know, homiletic bases for asserting that the patriarch shall not impose burdens upon the scholars. Then we go to another story. Another story is Rav Nachman bar Rav Chista, Rav Kagar Rabbanon. So Rav Nachman charged the tax on the rabbis, and Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak responded, "Avarta ad oraisa ad neviyai ad ksuvai. You violated the Torah, the Nevi'im, and the Ksuvim." Now, whenever somebody says you violated the Torah Nevi'im Ksuvim, or I can prove something from Torah Nevi'im Ksuvim, what are they really saying? That this is important to me, and I'm going to bludgeon you with proof texts that may or may not be all that compelling, but I'm going to cite them anyway because I want to crush you in the realm of learning, and so that your agenda shall fail. You shall not be able to do what you want to do. So charging the rabbis taxes elicited a really visceral response. You can't do that. It's against the Bible, right? Now, what really was going on here? The answer is that in 3rd century Eretz Yisrael, the economy was tanking. It was bad times, very bad times. And people were leaving the country, so the number of Jewish taxpayers was declining. and the middle class was losing, was becoming impoverished. So those who could afford to pay government taxes as collected by Jewish local officials was declining. Well, in a good economy, in the booming late 1990s American economy, could the federal government, could the IRS afford to allow rabbis in New York to have parsonages and some clergy exemptions? And is it going to bankrupt the country? No. But in 2008, during the Great Recession, if some rabbi says, I don't want to pay taxes because, you know, clergy, what's the non-clergy going to say? Shame on you. You know, we're all starving and the government is going broke and you're going to ask for exemptions? A chutzpah. So in good times, we can indulge in clergy exemptions. In bad times, you really can't. But the clergy who've been accustomed to the exemptions, and now you're trying to impose a tax on them, what are they going to say? Vez mir, you can't do such a thing. Shame on you.
Did the Romans tax individuals or like a town and the whole community?
The local authorities had the prerogative to choose who was going to pay the taxes, but the taxes collection was imposed by the higher provincial or imperial authorities. So you have now where the ethnarch of the Jews, the Nasi, is arrogated the responsibility to choose who's going to pay the taxes, but he's got to collect it because the bigger powers say we need the revenue. Okay, so let's take a look at Nedarim. The Nedarim says the following: Amar Rabbi Abahu, Amar Rabbi Elazar. If they manenash Avraham, why was Avraham punished? Sheishtablu banav leMitzrayim, that his children should go to be slaves in Egypt. Because he taxed the yeshiva boys. Now, wait a second. Avraham taxed the yeshiva boys? What is he, Yair Lapid? I mean, what is this? Come on. Avraham? So they quote a pasuk. They quote the pasuk that Avraham mustered 318 guys from his retinue. And what did they do? They rescued Lot. So what just happened here? A pasuk that teaches that Avraham was a tzaddik gomor, who did pidyon shvuyim, the biggest of all mitzvahs, is now being manipulated to say Avraham is a rasha, a balavera, because he taxed the yeshiva boys, who learned in his kolo. Come on! Okay, let's go to another example. The Gemara in Sota Daf Yud. Darash Rava, nanash Asa. Why was Asa punished? Melech Yehuda. Because he taxed the yeshiva boys. Okay? Now what's the pasuk? The pasuk is in Malachim Aleph 15:22, that after Basha was attacking the south and made fortifications or tried to build fortifications, but then he turned around and left. What did Asa do? He grabbed Givab Binyamin and Mitzpah and he tried to build it up and build up fortifications. And when the pasuk says, he shmi et kol Yehuda, ein naki, he mustered everyone. Nobody was naki. Nobody was exempt. No exemptions. No clergy exemptions. The Mefarshim on the Pasuk say, and other Gemaras say, that this was a good thing. After all, defense of Israel, defense of Am Yisrael, and even a chasan mechupaso, even a groom from his bridal canopy, gets called to serve in the war when on Yom Kippur, Egypt and Syria attack Israel. You know, in an emergency situation, everybody goes to war. So here, what happened? He did a good thing. And what does the Gemara do? Twisted around, no, he did a bad thing. He was punished because he taxed the yeshiva boys. So what do we see then? That in Talmudic times, in Amoraic times, they were willing to twist psukim to homiletic use to defend clergy exemptions. The Goyim knew about it and to an extent respected it at certain times and in certain places. And the Jews expected the Jews to recognize it. But who wasn't adhering to it? The Nasi. The Jewish ethnarch. Why? Out of emergency, out of necessity. But the rabbis pushed back. You can't do this sort of thing. So what emerged then was that there was collaboration between Rabbi Yochanan and the house of Gamliel, the patriarchate, the house of Rebbe, because Yochanan realized we need to work together to save Am Yisrael in a post-Temple era. But some rabbis who did not appreciate the realpolitik pushed back way too hard and said, no, we're not going to be in cahoots with the Nasi. The Nasi is just some Am Aretz and Yichus. We're going to defend the rights of the Talmid Chachamim to the hilt. And that's when you have this machlokis. And but one of the ways that the fundamentalist types, the Reish Lakish types, will prove their the legitimacy of their point is to go back to where we started. The tribe of Levi didn't work in Mitzrayim. So the whole notion of the tribe of Levi not working in Mitzrayim is not a real tradition that dates back from time immemorial. It's not really true. It's a tool in the arsenal of the fundamentalist anti-taxation rabbis of the third century to say, don't tax us. End of story. How do you like that?
Would everyone agree with that? I mean,
no, of course not.
I mean, why not? I mean, it's a good proof. I mean, that is...
Okay, well, listen, because there are those who read the Midrashim and will always assume that even if there is another agenda behind the Midrash, there's some purpose to the homily that on its surface, what it's saying reflects the history of our people. That it's not an untruth, a literal untruth. So therefore, if the Chazal say the Levi didn't work in Mitzrayim, it must be Levi didn't work in Mitzrayim. Whereas I take the perspective of Chazal can't know what they couldn't know. And they don't have traditions other than the biblical text about what really happened in the ancient patriarchal period. So whatever they're saying happens, they're saying because they want to serve some useful purpose in the here and now. As far as those rabbis were concerned, clergy exemption was an important thing. It allowed for the rabbis, for the Talmid Chachamim, to be unimpeded in their perpetuation of Torah. And the perpetuation of Torah is the most important thing for Klal Yisrael. So this was not out of venality. It wasn't because they're being a bunch of chazers. No, it was out of legitimate reason that they wanted to have free from the misim. But I read the Midrash as only agenda-based and not literally true.
Well, you could look at the pre-3rd century translations, either from Onkelos or the Septuagint, to see how they handle those that word that we first were dealing with, the Zlotechem, how Onkelos and how the Septuagint translated that.
Well, you know what? Hold the wire. Let me just look up on Bar Ilan's Judaica. I have all the Targumim right there. So give me 15 seconds for my old laptop to fire up. And
because that will prove in the pre-third century.
My guess is that there's no embellishment, that it'll just have a plain Aramaic translation of the word. But if there was going to be anything, it would be Targum Yonason, because that's a later translation and has a penchant for relying upon the Agadah to prove whatever point it wants to prove. Okay, give me 5 more seconds. 1 second. You may lose me for a bit. Can you still see me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So now I'm just opening up the other screen. And 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay, here we go. And Shemos, chapter 5, verse 4, Targumim. So Onkelos has Lepul Chonchon, your work. And the same thing in Targum Yonason. There's no embellishment at all. So it seems to be that this is a later development.
Uh-huh.
All right, guys. Well, on that note, I wish you a good Shabbos. And may you all stay safe. What's the Omicron situation in Israel?
Depends who you ask. Things are beginning to close down in various ways. I mean,
and are people getting sick or just they're testing positive?
They're just testing positive, it seems. Have you heard anyone getting sick from it?
Not really.
No. People are worried about it, and Jews can't come visit her anymore, you know, and it's a problem.
A problem, yeah. Well, may the problem go away.
But by the way, I have a book, you may have it. It's from Slifkin.
Yeah.
So it's called Rationalism versus Mysticism, Schisms in Traditional Jewish Thought. Now, it's not the same topic you had, but it's a rational approach versus a non, I don't want to say the word irrational, a non-rational approach. And it deals with this kind of a question. Why we translate, who translates things out of the pshat for whatever gender there is?
Yeah.
Now, of course, I asked a Moroccan-born chavruta of mine, and they're very mystical-oriented. So his perspective was, there's not a single word in the Gemara. That's not completely true. He doesn't like this historical approach. But
well, the good thing about it is that there is little downside. Well, I wouldn't say there's no downside, but there's little downside to the existence of that sort of fundamentalist perspective, because it just means that they'll sustain their religious attachments with a great degree of fervor, and those who want to think otherwise will think otherwise.
Right, sort of amounts to.
Okay, guys, take care. Good Shabbos.
And
Shalom.
Before Shabbos. Okay, guys, so was he positive, or he didn't say, right?
He didn't say. He said he...